morning. We've already heard a lot this morning. We've finally gotten to the message part. My name is Sharon Ellie. I'm not going to be talking about Purim, but it's been brought up a lot this morning. I am kind of dressed up myself. Anyone guess what I am? You know those pythons that swallow eggs and mice? Yeah. But Esther, we've heard about it this morning. It's a great story. It's a story of an orphan who gets put in such a position that she is able to save her people. But to do that, she has to grow, and it takes tremendous courage. And that's actually that theme. I won't talk about Esther, but that theme is what I want to look at this morning. Courage. I've been mulling over this for a couple months now, and it so happens that today was a day it would be delivered. Well, there's this phrase that says, ignorance is bliss. And in many ways, it's true. Gary and I are married. We have a three-and-a-half-year-old son, Sa'ar, and we've been watching him grow up really quickly. And I've noticed that some movies he used to watch when he was two didn't bother him at all. And he watches those same movies now, and he's afraid. And makes you realize that the more you grow, the more you see and experience, the more you understand, the more you realize what could go wrong, and that makes you afraid. Well, we're all looking for safety and security in life. Even for those of us who think we're not, I like to say I love surprises. If you were to tell me right now that someone stole our car, I wouldn't like that surprise. So really, I'm kind of lying. I like surprises as long as they're good, or at least neutral. I like a certain element of risk. But even still, you know, it's nice to know you have a family to go back to. It's nice to know you have a friend or a spouse or a friend who's a spouse. It's even better. Siblings. Or maybe you like to know you have a home you live in. That might be nice. Some people like that more than others. Maybe you like to know you have a steady salary. That would be nice too. These things, they give us a sense of security. We want some kind of guarantee in life. You know, will I ever accomplish that goal? Will I have enough money to pay rent? Or maybe if we're sick, will I ever get better? Will my kids be okay? You might be younger and say, will I ever get married? I know I wondered about that myself. There's always something to worry about. We have little fears and big fears. Is Iran going to nuke us all in 2 years? Or next year? Maybe that's in the back of some people's mind as you live in this area. Or something smaller, like, how am I going to tell my friend that I just lost the book they lent me? And the way I see it, all our fears boil down to three things. Yay, even four. Yes, I'm borrowing from Amos. I like Amos. The fourth would be if you include the fear of aloneness, emptiness, or meaningless in your list. But the three things I came up with were shame, pain, and death. And if you don't fear any of those to some degree, you're probably either really young and you've never experienced pain, or maybe you're dishonest, even to yourself. I have no doubt that I fear. I don't consider myself more paranoid than anyone else. I'm just not the type that's going to sail my ship out into the dark mist. And do you all remember who I'm referring to? If you think of, we've been reading Narnia to our boy, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. But in another book, there's this character, Reepa Cheep. He's the mouse. He's a two-foot mouse with a little sword. And I have a little description I got from Wikipedia on that summarizes him. I'll read it for you. Reepa Cheep is one of the most memorable and beloved characters in the Chronicles. Despite his size, he is the most valiant of all the talking beasts of Narnia. Lewis writes, quote, "His mind was full of forlorn hopes, death or glory charges, and last stands." That's in Voyage of the Dawn Treader, Chapter 5. He requests that he and his 11 mice be put at the front of the battle against Miraz's army. When the Telmarines express fear about entering the doorway back into our world, Reepa Cheep offers to lead his own mice through to set an example. This fearlessness makes Reepa Cheep an excellent companion aboard the Dawn Treader. On Dragon Island, Caspian has to forbid him from challenging a dragon, who turns out to be Eustace, to single combat. And of course, while all the others want to avoid the Dark Island, Reepa Cheep urges them to go forward into the blackness, and there they find the Lord Roop. He does not lose heart even when it seems they will never escape the Dark Island. When Caspian despairingly tells Reepa Cheep, "There are some things no man can face," the mouse replies, "It is then my good fortune not to be a man." Despite his fierce nature, Reepa Cheep is also a very courteous and polite mouse and a loyal follower of Aslan. Reepa Cheep's hunger for daring deeds leads him to the greatest adventure of all and his heart's desire, Aslan's country. Just before saying his goodbyes, he throws his sword into the ocean, saying, "I shall need it no more." And he basically swims off. So, that's not me. To give you a glimpse of me, I'm pretty much a coward. Not always, but I probably shared this story before about my preschool experience. But I have to do it again. So I had this teacher named Mrs. Reed, who was quite substantial stature. And she would get pretty upset sometimes. And I tended to exasperate her because I kind of marched a different drum. And I was a little different. And I never tried to cause problems. I just didn't think like other people. And I think I missed some cues, or maybe I just misinterpreted things she said or didn't hear them. Plus, I grew up in Africa in this village, and this was when we were in America on furlough in Southern California, so it was a totally different world for me. Anyway, she'd get really angry, and she'd bulge her eyes out, and she'd make these threats in this loud, booming voice. And in her defense, my family culture is not one that yells, so I found it maybe a little extra traumatic. I've since been somewhat desensitized. But I was late one morning, and apparently several mornings, and she had made this threat that if I was late one more time, and I'm so traumatized I can't even remember what the threat was. I remember the one more time, and that was going to be the end of the world. So I'm the youngest of three kids. My mom had to drop two other kids off at another school before me. So it was inevitable that there was going to be this one more time. So the day came, and I remember running to the school, the back hallway of the school. I opened the swing door. I remember the sound of my feet on that plastic mat, and then I'm running in the hallway. It's like that nice padded carpet, kind of like this. And I go to the classroom, and I was just hoping, you know, that I could make it. And I saw that the door was already shut. And that was it. That was the end of the world. And so I couldn't face her. I knew that, you know, this yelling big woman was behind that door. And I couldn't go in there knowing that I was late again. So I sat down next to the door, put my back to the wall, and I sat there with my little lunch bag, and I just didn't know what to do. And I kept sitting there, and I'd probably still be sitting there if the principal didn't come along and ask me what I was doing. And I don't remember. I must have explained something of what had gone on. Because he offered to go in with me and talk to my teacher. So that's what happened. And miracle of miracles, she didn't yell at me, and it was all okay. By the way, I did see Mrs. Reed again a couple years ago. She seemed a little smaller than she used to, and I think she's lost a lot of weight. But she's a nice lady. You know, I saw her at a church. She came up to me and she said, "I don't know if you remember me. I taught you preschool." And I just smiled and said, "I remember you." Inside, I was like, "You have no idea." Anyway, it was nice. But that's how we cope, you know. Well, that's how I cope. And a lot of us, it's a very human thing to do. We avoid. We run away when we're so afraid that we can't face what's ahead. Now, sometimes I have courage, and, you know, I have other stories. But usually, when you think you have courage, it's probably just a sign that you're not really afraid enough. For instance, we had guests once to the same said village in southern Sudan, and I was six this time, and these two adults wanted me to take them out on a walk. So I was used to playing in the forest. I said, "Sure, I'll take you out on a walk." And I wanted to impress them. And I remembered my parents had taken me on this trail recently. I'd been on it once. And it was this nice long walk. And I was like, they'll like that. So I set out. And I got about half hour into it. I wasn't afraid at all. But I didn't necessarily know exactly where I was going. And again, this is southern Sudan. We're out in the middle of nowhere in the forest. So, and there's snakes and wild animal, lions, sure, everything. And it's actually late in the afternoon and starts getting darker. And so my adult friends keep asking, "So how far from the house are we?" I was like, "Oh, we're, you know, we'll get there pretty soon." And I was being deliberately vague because I really didn't know how far we were from the house. But I just kept following the cues, you know. I'm like, "Oh, yeah, I remember that rock there, and then we went this way." And to me, it was all just a big challenge of, you know, could I repeat this walk? So the adults might have been afraid. I really wasn't that afraid. And somehow in the end, I just kept telling them stories, talking about the scenery, and I led them just at sunset. I remember seeing the wing of the airplane they came in our brick house, and I was like, "Oh, see, here we are." And they were very relieved. So I might have appeared courageous. Maybe I was, but it was more the ignorance is bliss. And then when I was 14, well, maybe 12 to 14, I don't know, I was at that stage of, you know, I wanted to challenge Daniel in the Bible, you know. "Send me to solitary confinement, I can handle it. I can eat vegetables and water, you know, anything. God, here I am, you know, bring it on. Anything you want, I'm ready." Now I find that more commonly I just pray, "Lord, have mercy." But there is this resounding theme in the Bible, very simple, and it seems so hard. It's have courage. We have variations of it all over the place. I'll read you a couple verses of Jesus' words. It's also interesting when he says it, but that's a whole other sermon maybe. Matthew 9:2. "Just then some people brought to him a paralytic lying on a stretcher. When Jesus saw their faith, he said to the paralytic, Have courage, son. Your sins are forgiven. Matthew 9:22. When Jesus turned and saw her, he said, Have courage, daughter. Your faith has made you well. And the woman was healed from that hour. Matthew 14:27. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, Have courage. It is I. Do not be afraid. Mark 6:50. For they all saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them, Have courage. It is I. Do not be afraid. Mark 10:49. Jesus stopped and said, Call him. So they called the blind man and said to him, Have courage. Get up. He's calling you. And a big one we'll probably read again today, John 16:33. I've told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have trouble and suffering, but take courage. I have conquered the world. 2 Corinthians 5:6. Therefore we are always full of courage. And we know that as long as we are alive here on earth, we are absent from the Lord. Then a couple verses down, we are full of courage and would prefer to be away from the body and at home with the Lord. So courage, it keeps popping up all over the place. This quality of the mind or spirit that enables us to face difficulty or danger or pain or any of those bad stuff without fear. Well, this morning, I want to look at a couple stories that will help us to have that courage. The first one, we'll look at Moses and Paul. The first one I want to look at is in Exodus 3 and 4. So you can turn there. And I know Gary just talked about Moses in the burning bush several weeks ago. So I'll try not to revisit too many points. This is Moses' first meeting with God directly. Acts says earlier that when he killed the Egyptian, you know, he was looking forward to God saving his people by his hand. So maybe he had his young, courageous side too. But I think at this point, he doesn't really know what's going on. And he hasn't met God directly. And now he gets his commissioning by God. Look at verse 9 and 10 of chapter 3 of Exodus. God says, And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now, go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? Okay, it's understandable that Moses would be a little nervous. He's fled Egypt. He's left all of that behind. And he has a bad record there, too, on top of it. I mean, I think a lot of times we read these stories and we don't put ourselves fully in their shoes. Of course, Moses' shoes are off right now, but you know what I'm talking about. We don't really think, like, what would I be like if this happened to me? God's asking him to go back and face a Pharaoh. So he's nervous. And what's God's answer and his great reassurance? It's verse 12. And God said, I will be with you. And this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. Well, two things strike me here. I will be with you. It's not a very tangible promise. You know, it's I can identify with Moses a lot. Like, that's great, God. I know you're with me. You're always with me. But how does that help me? Something could still go wrong because I've seen it go wrong for other people, and you're with them too. You know? Well, I know you're good and all of that, but, you know, it's just so vague. I want something more of a promise to hold on to. And then he gets this curious sign that's not really a sign, because signs are supposed to be before and confirm what's going to happen. And this sign is after the fact. It's like, okay, well, after I've already done it all, then I can be reassured once I finally make it to this mountain that it was you that sent me. Very strange sign. The sign itself requires that Moses has courage. So Moses brings up, what am I going to say to the other people? Look at the next verse, 3:13. Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? Then what shall I tell them? Okay, so Moses is bringing up all the what ifs. And God says to Moses, I am who I am. Okay, again, it's like very vague, and it's very kind of frustrating to Moses. It never seems to be quite what the security he's looking for. He wants a bit of a script, he wants a letter of recommendation, and he's not getting what he wants. Thankfully, God does fill it in a bit more for him. In verses 15 and 22, he does say what's going to happen. And it's not all good. He tells them what to say. And look at verse 19. But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go, even with a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and strike the Egyptians with all the wonders that I will perform among them. And after that, he will let you go. Well, great. There's going to be a lot of hurdles along the way. That doesn't sound very fun. And after that, everything's vague. Well, how long is that going to take? What kind of wonders? What's going to happen? There's nothing secure in there. Except that the ending does appear to be good, because they get to plunder the Egyptians and they will get to leave. But Moses has more questions. Look at the beginning of chapter 4, verse 1. He's not convinced that the people are going to believe him. What if they do not believe me or listen to me and say the Lord didn't actually appear to you? Then the Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? And that's when he gets the three signs. He gets the rod that turns into a snake and back again. He gets the hand that becomes leprous and back again. And if they don't believe the first two, then he gets to go take Nile water and pour it out and it'll turn into blood. So those are pretty cool signs. But Moses has another problem. He, in verse 10, he says, I got a heavy mouth and a heavy tongue. You know, you can debate what exactly that means. He's obviously not feeling very eloquent. Sometimes I really identify with that myself. Especially after learning another language. Sometimes I just cannot express myself in any language. So what is God's answer? Again, look at verse 11. Exodus 4:11. Who do you think made the mouth? Verse 12. I will be with your mouth, and I'll teach you what to say. So Moses kind of has run out of excuses, and then in verse 13, he's still uncomfortable, and he says, can't you just send someone else? Okay, God, send by the hand you'll send, meaning some other messenger. And that makes God angry. But he does it. He says, fine, I'll send you someone else. I'll send you Aaron to help you. And we know he likes to talk. We see it in the parasha this week. Well, he's called a ish dvarim, a person of words. But in our little parasha on the golden calf, remember Moses comes down and asks him, what happened? He said, well, you know these people and how they are, and they gave me all their jewelry, and I just threw it in the fire, and out popped this golden calf. So he seems to be pretty good with spontaneous speech. But Moses doesn't get out of his calling. God's going to give Moses the words to put in Aaron's mouth. And God will be with Moses' mouth and with Aaron's mouth. And he'll speak to the people, and Moses will be like God to him. So as I say, as I'm looking at this story of Moses, the person who leads everybody out of slavery, I identify a lot with this initial picture of Moses, who seems to be a bit of a coward. He wants assurances like the rest of us. How will he know everything's going to be okay? And what if something goes wrong? Can't he avoid this somehow? And the truth is, we don't get very absolute assurances in life. And there's really just one guarantee that God gives. And it's not everything's going to be okay. It's I will be with you. If you're like me, you're a little more interested in results. At first, it seems a bit like a cop-out on God's part. Like a flimsy promise. You know, okay, you're calling me to go out and say this to whoever, they might beat me up. Great, you'll be with me, but I'll still get beaten up. But there's one thing that changes this into the most profound promise that there is, and that is knowing what it means, who God is. Knowing God, I will be with you. Because anyone else in the universe who make this promise, it would be a flimsy promise. I mean, it would be nice, sympathetic, thank you, but it wouldn't really change anything. And somehow, mysteriously, God's presence does make a difference. And he is enough. He is ultimately all that we need. I mean, what the definition of heaven is that he will be with us. We will be with him. Being with him is everything. Oh, thank you. So, if he's there and we know it, then nothing else matters. Skip forward hundreds of years to Acts 23. And here we have Paul. This is when he went up to Jerusalem. Poor Paul, he's really frustrated. He's completely misunderstood by people. He's following God, he's keeping the law, and he's preaching Jesus resurrected. And people are against that, the Jesus part. And he gets imprisoned in Jerusalem. And he even gets pulled into custody for his own protection because the crowd's about to destroy him. Look at Acts 23, verse 11. Oh, wait, don't look at 11 yet. Look earlier. He gets pulled in before them. Let's look at verse 6. Paul, knowing that some of them were Sadducees and the others Pharisees, called out in the Sanhedrin, "My brothers, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. I stand on trial because of my hope in the resurrection of the dead." When he said this, a dispute broke out between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. The Sadducees say there is no resurrection, and that there are neither angels nor spirits, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. So there was a great uproar, and some of the teachers of the law, who were Pharisees, stood up and argued vigorously. "We find nothing wrong with this man," they said. "What if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him?" The dispute became so violent that the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them. He ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him into the barracks. So Paul is kind of at a low point here. He's not having much success with his message. He's being misunderstood. And he's in jail. He doesn't know what's going to happen to him. And then, now look at verse 11. "The following night, the Lord stood near Paul and said, 'Take courage. As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome.'" All right. So here we have the same thing going on. Take courage. Why should he take courage? Well, or how should he take courage? Because the Lord was standing next to him. He was right there near him. His presence. And yet look at the message. As you've testified about me in Jerusalem, which isn't going over so well, so you will testify about me in Rome. That's not really good news. Why am I going to Rome? Because you're going to appeal to Caesar, and you're still going to be in jail. And we all know what happened to Paul in the end. He got beheaded. That's not very fun. And yet, take courage. Paul is still able to take courage. If you follow it out to the end of Acts, you see, you know, Paul's pretty smart too. He knows how to play his cards, right? His citizenship, being a Roman. And he does get people to try to help him so that he doesn't get turned over and get killed in Jerusalem. He gets to go to Rome first. He survives a shipwreck, and he's probably the only one who has courage during that time. He survives a snake bite. Those things all take the courage. And in each of those instances, that courage doesn't come from himself. In each case, he says, you know, the Lord somehow made his presence right there with Paul. And that's where his source of courage was able to come from. Didn't write down the verse, but in the shipwreck story, he tells people that specifically, that an angel of God told him, or was with him, appeared to him. 27:23. Thank you. Someone's still awake out there. Last night, an angel of the God whose I am and whom I serve stood beside me and said, "Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar. And God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you." So he says, "So keep up your courage, men, for I have faith in God that it will happen just as he told me." And it's still going to be hard. I mean, in life, we're still going to get shipwrecked. We're still going to get bitten by snakes. And we still don't ultimately know, you know, maybe we will die. Maybe, you know, who knows what's going to happen. But we have the biggest promise of all to hold on to, that God will be with us. Even Jesus. Let's look at Jesus now. John chapter 16, verse 32 to 33. This is towards the end of Jesus' ministry. He says, "But a time is coming and has come when you will be scattered, each to his own home. You will leave me all alone. Yet I am not alone, for my Father is with me." So Jesus is going to experience his own stress, his own fears, where all his friends desert him. "Yet I am not alone, for my Father is with me. I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble." Thanks. "But take heart," this translation, or "have courage. I have overcome the world." That's the ultimate truth. He's overcome the world. And Paul, even at the end of his life, writing from Rome in 2 Timothy, it's one of the last epistles, we have our famous song, you know, I know whom I have believed, and am persuaded that he is able to keep my deposit for that day. We can have courage because we know whom we have believed, and we know who is with us. We get this promise before in Isaiah 26:3. You will keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on you because he trusts in you. So, what I'm trying to talk about today isn't something we can conjure up. I can be the first to tell you that. Most of the times when I'm feeling courageous, it's fake. And when something comes and really tests my courage, I realize I'm still a wimp. We can't conjure it. The only way we can get it is God's presence, communing with God. And I know sometimes we get promises from God that everything's going to be okay, and I love those. But sometimes we don't get those promises. And the promise, the one guarantee we have, is that God will be with us. God of the universe, the good God, full of mercy and compassion, he's going to be with us. And do we know him well enough for that promise to be enough for us? Can we trust him ultimately that that's enough? Back to Esther. Esther fasted for 3 days before she went to see the king. The text doesn't actually say that she prayed, but I'm thinking she probably did. I think the author on purpose was trying not to mention God, so he couldn't mention that little religious aspect. But he was hinting that God's working behind the scenes. And funny thing for me is all the times in my life that I've been most courageous have been after I fasted. It also reminds me of the parashat this week, how Moses, when he sees God, he gets, his face shines or his face grows horns. I don't know. We'll go with the shine interpretation. Something happens that transforms him because he's been in God's glory, and it slowly fades away. And it's like, you know, fasting might be that thing for you. When you've been with God, you have this this extra zing, I don't know, this courage that you can face things, but it will fade if you don't repeat it. The only way to get it again is to be back with God and to actually experience his very real presence. There's a tradition that when Esther went to meet the king, she said, Psalm 22, into your hands I commit my spirit. Same thing we hear on the cross. She said, if I perish, I perish. So this morning, I don't know what kind of adventure you're on. I don't know what fears you might have or what you don't want to face. I know that we all have troubles. We all have things maybe that, you know, we're afraid of shame right now or some kind of pain. Or maybe we're afraid of dying. There's always something. And I'd like to encourage us all to think about these stories. And even Reepa Cheep. Think about good old Reepa Cheep. The kind of courage that forgets about yourself completely and makes you just go out there boldly because you know who is standing next to you. It's not about you anymore. It's about God. And if God is there, if we know that, that actually really is enough. So may you be encouraged on your adventure with him and feel his presence today.
The theme has run through the whole morning of things that have happened and how that God has promised to be with us and encourages a very central component in all these things if we're going to live a life with him. And let's all stand. And I would urge those that need to make that first step with him. It takes courage even to start the journey. And the journey is not trouble-free and not pain-free. But as Sharon rightly said, he promised to be with us. And so if you're here this morning needing to begin that journey with him, I'd urge you to do that at this time. Let's all pray. Father, we thank you and praise you for your goodness and mercy to us. And Lord, that you promised never to leave us nor forsake us. And we sense your presence even now. And Lord, in those times that you seem distant and your presence is seemingly nowhere to be found, we know you're still there. So, Father, we pray that we will leave this place with encouraged in the Lord to intensify our walk with you, to draw closer to you. And Lord, for each one who may be in the sound of our voice here today, we trust that they'll be take the courage to make that first step with you, and you'll meet them halfway. We bless you and thank you now for the new birth that's taking place in hearts and lives today. In Jesus' name.